Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I think I'm in the wrong room, but I have to give a talk anyway, apparently. And the title of the talk really isn't very descriptive. I want to give an overview of two areas that have been of interest to me for many, many years, and it'll be kind of a historical overview of some of these problems, and I've actually made some small contributions to them. And the title of the talk really isn't very descriptive in that there are two specific areas that I'm interested in. Certain aspects of computational number theory, in particular the discrete logarithm problem, and some ways that the discrete logarithm problem have influenced some protocols, cryptographic protocols that we've also worked on. So to give you a flavor of what it is I'll be talking about towards the end of my talk, I'll introduce a secure multi-party computation, which is really an area I shouldn't be talking about because I don't have the right kind of complexity background to be talking about it. It's more the computational number theory and how computational number theory interacts with protocols that I'm interested in. And but I'm going to go ahead anyway. I don't like to see Charlie Rakoff and Steve Cook in the audience at all. So the idea here, the kind of the beautiful example, and I think maybe the first real example of a secure multi-party computation in my books is Andrew Yao's so-called millionaire protocol, whereby you have X dollars and I have Y dollars, and we wish to enter into a protocol to determine who is richer without divulging any further information. So there's one bit of information going to get transferred, and anybody can look at the transfers of information and hopefully gain nothing about it. And at the end of the protocol, one of us has one bit of information, namely you're richer than me or I'm richer than you. And so this kind of protocol, this information transfer without divulging any further information, is what I'm really interested in. And in order to get to it, more of my experience is with computational number theory, so I really had to talk about it. So the overview of the talk is really how to look at certain computational number theoretic problems and a few examples of secure multi-party protocols. As I mentioned before, secure multi-party protocols is a very deep area of computer science, and I'm going to give you some really trivial and almost embarrassing examples of what I'm talking about there. The discrete logarithm problem occupies a special place in computational number theory for me, in that it keeps reinventing itself in new forms, and I'll be talking about some of that. So a good bit of the first part of the talk is, in fact, on the discrete logarithm problem. And just to give you a little background, there are kind of two types of functions that are interesting in cryptography. They're one-way functions, and the whole talk is going to be an overview, informal. I'm not going to take the time to be very specific, but a one-way function basically is one that it's easy to compute in one way, and it's very difficult to invert for almost all of the elements in the domain. So given a y in the image, to find an x such that fx equals y is difficult. There are some people who feel that such functions don't in fact exist, but the examples I use in cryptography are good enough for the immediate future anyway. We're still hoping desperately that quantum computing doesn't make much of an impact on cryptography, but it certainly has the potential to destroy it. A trapdoor one-way functions is that it's easy to compute in one way, but very difficult to invert unless additional information is available, in which case the inversion is very easy. And the granddaddy of examples here is the RSA technique, but more generally, if I give you an integer n that is the product of two primes, and whether you can construct protocols that depend for its security on your ability to factor n, and square roots, taking square roots modulo n, is formally equivalent to factoring, and so there are some protocols, unfortunately not very efficient, that depend on square roots. So these are the two problems, and as I say, the one I find the most interesting, integer factorization is interesting and quite an art form in itself, but I'm going to be talking about the discrete logarithm problem. And if we look in the non-zero integers modulo a prime p, suppose alpha is primitive, the problem simply stated is, if I give you alpha and p and y equal alpha to the x, find x for me. So a good bit of the security software available today depends on this being a difficult problem to find x. Now, there are certain provisos on the prime p. You can't just pick any prime p for it to have any chance of being secure. The paper that spawned this is a 1976 paper by two Stanford people, Diffie and Hellman, and they pointed out that, if this is in fact a difficult problem, and back then it was really not known that it was a difficult, whether it was a difficult problem. They looked at it for a while. It was apparently a suggestion of John Gill at Stanford that, well, why don't you, they were talking about what's a hard problem to invert but easy to compute. And John Gill proposed this discrete logarithm mod p. And their paper said essentially, well, if this is in fact a hard problem, then we can actually do key exchange over a public medium. If you send me alpha to the A and I send you alpha to the B, then we both have enough information to compute alpha to the AB, and we'll use that or some bits in the expansion of alpha to the A bit alpha to the AB as our common key for, let's say, a symmetric encryption algorithm, which would be known to be secure for all of our purposes. So the real problem is, how difficult is the discrete logarithm problem? And this kind of began around 1978 when Edelman and Wang at USC proposed an algorithm, and so certainly there's kind of a simple square root algorithm called Chang's baby step giant step algorithm, and here one way I can illustrate that, if you think of this as the integers, if you compute alpha to the A up to about the square root of p, and if you're given an element here, alpha to the x, you keep trying to step alpha to the x back by steps on the order of square root of p until you land in the region where you can kind of decode the exponent and find out what the answer is. So that's a square root algorithm, and this works in any group. Of course, we happen to be working here in the group of non-zero integers mod p, the multiplicative group of the finite field. There was a piece of work very early on that said, well, actually, if p minus 1 is only composed of small primes, if the factorization of p minus 1 has only small primes, then it's quite an easy problem. And in fact, the complexity of finding discrete logs then is proportional to the largest prime divisor of p minus 1. Pollard Rho is a random algorithm that works very effectively in practice and takes almost no space, but is essentially has the same complexity of the baby step giant step. And then there was an index calculus technique where you actually look at all primes up to some level. You create what we call a factor base of primes, and you attempt to find all the discrete logarithms of these primes to the fixed base alpha. It sounds peculiar. I mean, the point of this is to find a discrete logarithm of a fixed alpha to the x, and now you're saying, well, but I have to find all the discrete logarithms of these primes first. And I'm not going to go into any detail in anything I'm going to talk about, but the notion works extremely effectively because there's a notion of size of integers, norms, and what we call smooth integer. An integer now will be called smooth if all of its prime divisors are in your factor base. So if there are no large prime divisors outside of your factor base. And then if you carefully balance the number of primes that you're trying to find the discrete logarithms in your factor base versus the size of the whole thing, you can make it very efficient. And here's the answer that we currently have. We define this function L of sub NAC, where N now is actually the size of the prime. N would be the prime number. And this function LN is very popular in number theory. It's a log to the A N log the 1 minus A of N. And for discrete logarithms, the best algorithm we have, the critical factor here is this exponent A. And when A is the best we've ever been able to do is to have A is 1/3. This is called a sub-exponential algorithm. When A is equal to 1, it's exponential in log N. And when A is equal to 0, it's polynomial in log N. So for A in between 0 and 1, it's somewhere between polynomial and exponential, and we simply call it sub-exponential. And interestingly enough, most techniques for factoring integers have been modified to find discrete logarithms. And they kind of both use this notion of a factor base in each case, so perhaps it's not surprising. The best algorithm so far is a number field sieve technique, which uses algebraic number theory in a fairly straightforward way. Well, we actually did an implementation of this index calculus, not number field sieve. That's kind of in doubt. From a theoretical point of view, the number field sieve does achieve the 1/3. We actually had an algorithm here, and I've got this backwards. Sorry about that. This was a 1/2, and Don Coppersmith at IBM very quickly pointed out that you can do it in 1/3. So for a particular finite field, not the integers mod p. So we've had this problem around for some time now, and there are other problems associated with discrete logs, which are actually quite interesting. So again, if I just restrict my attention to the integers mod p, the discrete logarithm problem, oops, I left out a latex command, give an alpha to the x find x. Now, a computational problem, if you remember in the Diffie-Hellman key exchange, I was sending alpha to the A and I was receiving alpha to the B back, and everybody in the world knows alpha and the prime. And the question is, if they know alpha to the A and the alpha to the B, they see alpha to the A and alpha to the B flying around on the internet, can you compute alpha to the AB? As far as we know, the answer is no. That as far as we know, you would have to be able to actually take discrete logarithms in order to be able to compute alpha to the AB. Everything here is mod p, by the way. I just got lazy in putting mod p everywhere. And the third problem is, suppose you could try to guess at alpha to the B, call it alpha to the C. If you know alpha to the A, alpha to the B, alpha to the C, is there any way that you can verify or not whether C is actually equal to AB? And for the integers mod p, the answer seems to be no. But there are other groups we can work in where the answer is this last problem, the so-called DDH, the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem, is trivial, but the computational Diffie-Hellman problem is very difficult. So there are different, quite different complexities depending on what kind of a group you're in. We're always in some kind of a group for this application. So broadly speaking, if you can find discrete logs, you can certainly do the computational Diffie-Hellman. If you can do computational Diffie-Hellman, you can actually do the DDH problem. So that's the hierarchy of the three problems. Now, one small contribution that we actually recently made to this problem was, again, if you look at the computational Diffie-Hellman problem, meaning if I give you alpha to the A and alpha to the B, would you compute alpha to the AB for me? That's the computational problem. It's a bit of a precursor. If I just ask you, if I give you alpha to the X and ask you to give me information about X, it's easy to find the least significant bit of X in a discrete log problem because you can easily determine whether it's a quadratic residue or not. But that's an aside. For the computational Diffie-Hellman problem, the main one I'm interested in here, Bonnet and Venkatesan in the late 90s showed that actually, if you can give me on the order of the square root of n bits of alpha to the AB, if you have an algorithm to give me the least significant square root n bits, then in fact they had an algorithm to compute the whole alpha to the AB. We recently showed that, in fact, if we give you 1 plus epsilon bits, it has to be more than one bit of alpha to the AB, we can actually complete and find all alpha to the AB. But, of course, finding 1 plus epsilon bits is the key here. The proof is interesting. It uses the LLL algorithm finding shortest vectors in lattices, integer lattices. So the whole area of cryptography has been of great interest to mathematicians, a great source of funding at least. And so other groups very quickly came on stream. In the mid-80s, Koblitz and Victor Miller proposed, well, why not look at the additive group of points in an elliptic curve? And this has actually taken off. In the news this morning, the one company in the world that does elliptic curve cryptography, Certicom in Mississauga, the stock jumped about 40% on news. They sold their elliptic curve software to the NSA for $25 million. So this is, you know, mathematicians like to see these figures. The next thing is kind of the divisive group of a hyperelliptic curve, and then Kumar Murthy, being who he is, wants to work in abelian varieties, and the group at UT Mississauga, where the lab is, has done an enormous amount of work in this area. And then there's a group in Calgary, Hugh Williams, one of the really fine people in this area, works in the ideal class group of an algebraic number field. He's actually gathered, I think, three or four people who work intensively in that area. So if I can just give you a very brief taste of why the elliptic curve has proven to be so popular. If you look at, again, I'll just look at mod p. If you look at the set of solutions of a equation y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b over the integers mod p, if you tried to, of course, we can't really draw this curve mod p. So if we pretend that we're working over the real numbers for a minute, that if you draw a straight line through any two points, you're guaranteed that it will intersect the curve in a unique third point. It's a cubic. It's either got one or three solutions in the reals. If you give two solutions, it has to have the third. And so the way of there's a natural addition then on the set of solutions of this, and it's, if you add these two points, you can show very quickly that the third point that I've indicated will give you a very nice abelian group. And perhaps you could, well, you don't want to spend very much time on this, but these things have been studied very extensively. It's a very deep area of mathematics, at least to my way of thinking. It's a very deep field, and I think most people would agree with you. And by the Hasse-Wey theorem, the number of points, we kind of know something about it. To within a range of 4 square root of p, we know how many points will be on the curve, which is critical for us because we want to look at a subgroup of these points and use these points, let's say, to do a Diffie-Hellman key exchange on these points. And I will get to the point of this in a minute. The original work of Skouf on point counting really wasn't applied to point counting. Apparently, when he first submitted the paper, they said this is of no interest, and he then applied it to finding square roots, and then it became of interest. But of course, the people in cryptography found it of great interest because we in order to use an elliptic curve, you have to know the number of points on the curve. So the fact that it was of interest to cryptography spurred a lot of really fine mathematicians, Sato in Japan and Gaudry in France in particular. It came up with point counting techniques, I think, or a log p either squared or cubed. I think it's squared. And so a recent a paper from France, maybe 2-3 years ago now, actually counted points over a finite field characteristic 2 of order something like 2 to the 15,000 in a few hours on a computer. So these are very, very powerful techniques they've come up with. And what we actually want to do is to use a prime order subgroup of the elliptic curve. So you have to generate curves. The best type of curve is where the order of the entire curve is a small integer times a large prime. So there's great efforts in that direction. Now, there's one case in particular where you can get what we refer to as supersingular curves. And a supersingular curve is when the characteristic of the field divides this trace for Frobenius trace, which essentially tells you the order of the curve. And these curves have been interesting. For many, many years, they were thought to be, these are the kind of curves you would not use because the order is kind of p plus 1. It's not prime, so you'd have to divide out until you got a prime. The problem is that p plus 1 divides p squared minus 1, which is the multiplicative order of the finite field fp squared, and somehow there's this vague notion that when p plus 1 divides p squared minus 1, that can't be good. And sure enough, it's not good. The interesting thing here is that there are vast numbers of people around the world publishing vast numbers of papers on how to do arithmetic in large finite fields, and there's been a lot of work on normal bases. Much of it is very interesting. Well, I'm trying to rush through some of this stuff. I hope it still makes sense. So in an elliptic curve now, we consider the set of n torsion points where n is a prime. That is all points of the form AP, and NP is equal to the point at infinity. And the discrete log problem is, if I give you the point P and the curve and how to do arithmetic on it and the size of the group, the torsion group, if I give you AP, can you find me A? What multiple of a fixed point did I hand you? And there's the notions of computational Diffie-Hellman and decision Diffie-Hellman just go through as before. Now, the point of elliptic curves has been that there's no notion of smoothness on points in curves. We don't have the same techniques in order to allow us to launch a sub-exponential attack on this curve, if you choose the curve correctly, which I'm going to assume is what we're doing. And so, in fact, the only known attack is a baby step giant step, which is of square root, order square root of the size of the group. And so the fact that there's no sub-exponential is why this company, Certicom, exists. And so the discrete logarithm, if you use the finite field, let's say 2 to the 163, 163 happens to be a prime, and the NSA in the United States said that they kind of leaked it to the standards body. If you're going to use a field of characteristic 2, it should be 2 to a prime. And so all the standards are now built around so that you do use a prime. So if you look at the discrete logarithm in the finite field of characteristic 2, 2 to the 163, and compare that to the complexity of breaking, of factoring a 1024-bit integer, which is the product of two primes, this would be the RSA security, that these things are about the same order of complexity. And if you increase the discrete log, I think if you go up to about 3009, RSA becomes 4096. So the growth of the complexity, these are for the same level of security, but the growth in the size of the objects that you have to know how to multiply and or work with grow much smaller in the discrete log than they do for the RSA, which is the point. So the idea here is, for the same level of security, you can get away with processors that that have to work with much smaller objects. And I did mention this before, that there's the diffusion Diffie-Hellman problem, which was given alpha to the A, alpha to the B, and alpha to the C, does C equal to AB or not? And work done at Waterloo by Alfred Menezes and Scott Vanstone in a very nice paper showed how to use Weil pairing, which is a bilinear pairing from, say, the intorsion points on an elliptic curve to the set of nth roots of unity in a finite field. So I'm sorry, I should mention. So this is in some extension of a finite field. Okay. And so the pairing, the Weil pairing, takes the points A, P, B, Q, and you can, it has the property that it's actually the Weil pairing of P and Q raised to the AB power. Now, for a Weil pairing, Q has to be independent of P, a fine point. The problem here is that the nth roots of unity, so this is only going to work if you can find an integer k so that n divides p to the k minus 1. And for most of the curves that you will come up with, k is going to be so large that the sub-exponential algorithm in the finite field has actually greater complexity than the square root algorithm in the original elliptic curve. So the fact that this mapping always exists is fine, but it's not going to help you in most of the cases. Unfortunately, for the supersingular cases I mentioned, that the extension of the field is fairly small. In fact, Vanstone and Menezes showed that it's always less than 6, and so these curves are explicitly excluded from all the standards that use elliptic curves. So the point here now is, and I'll cheat a little bit. There's a second kind of a pairing called a Tate pairing, which is a little easier to work with. You can actually find points P for a Tate pairing where the bilinear application on the same point is not equal to the identity. And in this case, to show that the computational, that the diffusion Diffie-Hellman problem is easy, you simply apply this Tate pairing to the pair AP, BP, and it has to be this psi A to B, where psi is a primitive nth root of unity in the extension field. And then you compare it to this other point, PCP, which is epsilon C, and now you're simply comparing two elements in a finite field, and that's a trivial task. So in this particular group, the diffusion Diffie-Hellman problem is trivial, but this appears to be an exception. So this has been applied to identity-based encryption. And I guess there are some questions about this, and I won't go into it. This particular fact, at the moment, has some very interesting applications in cryptography. I'll just go over this very quickly. So there are other groups. There are many other groups. Mathematicians are good at groups. And so hyperelliptic curves, unfortunately, we go to actually a Jacobian in a hyperelliptic group, which is a formal integer sum of points on the curve here, which is of the form y squared plus hxy plus f of x. And this will be a genus curve if the degree h is less than or equal to g and the degree of f on the right-hand side is equal to 2g plus 1. And this, in the last 5 years, these have been very popular. And the Jacobi, so in this group, you know how to multiply two so-called points on the, sorry, add two points in the group. This is an additive group we're talking about. And so it's a formal sum m sub I, p sub I, where p sub I was a point on the curve, and so there's a natural addition. And sorry, a finite number, the sum is a finite sum of points. That is only a finite number of the integers m sub I are non-zero. And actually, the Jacobian that we work with is actually a factored group of divisors of degree zero over principal divisors. And so Kumar Murthy has a lab at UT Mississauga, the Ganesha lab, and they've done an enormous amount of work on point counting and how to do arithmetic in this group. doing arithmetic in this group is much harder than in the elliptic curves. But there's a group in Germany who's very serious about applying this to smart cards. These are hyperelliptic curves, and I'll very briefly indicate why that happens. So here you can show that the Jacobian, when you look at the set of points over an extension field of the field the curve is defined over, so let's say fq to the r, that it's kind of q to the r over 2 to the twice of the genus, so this kind of q to the rg. Recently, Gaudry, about 3 or 4 years ago, Gaudry in France showed that in fact there is a kind of a smoothness result available for the Jacobian, and that he was able to come up with an algorithm over where the curve is over fq that's of the order q squared plus g factorial, where g is the genus of the curve, times q. Well, for a fixed genus, this is kind of order q squared. And the impact of this result was that for cryptography, you would never use a curve of genus greater than 4 because the Gaudry attack now becomes more efficient than a square root attack, which was the only other attack we had. So the people in Germany are looking at, because smart cards in Germany are far better, or in Europe in general, are far more developed than in North America, for a strange reason, they're very interested in trying to get a much higher level of security with 32-bit processors. And the feeling was with hyperelliptic curves, they can actually achieve it. So that was why they were interested in it. So far, I've only talked about the discrete log problem. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about these secure multi-party computation. And as I say, it's a very deep field, and I'm not going to treat it as deep at all. I just want to give you a few examples of what I'm calling secure multi-party computation, but the real practitioners might be kind of horrified of what I'm interested in. So what I'm really interested in is this notion that we can somehow come to a decision on information that we have separately in a joint fashion without leaking any of our information. So this will convince you that I shouldn't have been invited. There are three very trivial examples that actually there's some interesting papers on these examples that which is kind of surprising. So there's these are the I'll just look at the first and the third one. So where's Waldo? Let me show you here. So Waldo are children's books. I don't know if you're aware of children's, if you have grandchildren, you know about these things. So this is Waldo here, actually, and the Where Waldo book had page after page of these complicated pictures. Am I supposed to turn it over? Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes, that's much better. So this is Waldo, and in any picture you have these characters, and so the idea is to... for you to find Waldo in this picture, you see. Now, I think there's a point here. I'm not entirely sure of it. So the idea is that I have to convince you that I know where Waldo is without giving you any information about where Waldo is. I mean, there must be a point. The authors of this paper are actually quite good people. And... If you're interested, Waldo is actually right here. But so the question here is, how do I convince you that I know where Waldo is without actually telling you? I just did. Well, I could see the look on your face, John, of anticipation, and I couldn't. So one thing I could do is I could have a large sheet of paper with a very tiny hole in it, and I could place it over just right with the hole over Waldo's face, and because the piece of paper is so large, you wouldn't know where the transparency underneath is. So in fact, I can solve it, but the solution is most unsatisfying in that it's a physical solution, And I think when I first described the problem to you, maybe you were thinking of a mathematical solution, and so it's kind of cheating. But nonetheless, we did solve the problem. You are now happy. You should be satisfied that, yeah, I can convince you that I know where Waldo is because I showed it to you. But you have no information about where it is. If I took the piece of paper off and asked you to find Waldo, if you're like me, it might take you half an hour or so. So here's another rather silly problem, but this is the complaint. So Alice and Bob are managers in a company, and they've each received a complaint from an employee about a person called Charlie. I'm sorry, Charlie. It was ABC. So the problem is, how do you determine if these two people who complained were the same person, in which case you might be inclined to dismiss the person as a bit of a crank, or different people? But you don't want to tell the other person who complained because they might get a bad reputation or there may be legal issues involved. So you don't want to reveal to each other who the complainer was. Well, there are various physical things you can have. You can, on a call message system, A can call up and leave a message for the person who complained to A. And then B can come along and call into the message center and ask, do you have a message for the person who complained to me? And if the answer is no, then you know that the two people are different. If the answer is yes, by the way, both people know who the complainer is, of course, who the one complainer is. And you can do the same with airline reservations. Alice can change a password on a system that everybody has access to, and if you type in your complainer's name and it's the same name as the original of the other complainer, then you know that the fact that you've been able to log in. But this problem is a little more interesting than the silly Waldo problem. Why? Because, well, one can think of kind of a set intersection problem. So we each have a database, and we would like to know how many files in the database we have in common without identifying what the files are. So for example, suppose Visa and MasterCard at U of T want to go into a deal, and they want to know how many people in the U of T community have, let's say, both Visa and MasterCard, because that might affect how much they're going to charge each other to launch some kind of a joint campaign. But they don't want to reveal who their users are. So, okay, the idea here is now that we each have large binary n-tuples, and we want to know where we both have ones. Each position of the binary n-tuple corresponds to a user or a name or a file, whatever, and we want to know how many ones. This is the same as finding what is the Hamming distance between your two n-tuples. It's the same problem. And we have a very nice, and again, you don't want to identify which positions you have ones in that are common. You just want to know what the global answer is. So there's information being leaked, but it's information you want. So we have a student, Vlad Kolesnikov, who's been working on some of these problems, and he has a nice kind of solution to this problem where you try not to leak any more information than you absolutely have. So this complaint problem, you can solve it in a physical sense, but it has a nice feature that you can solve it in a real cryptographic sense too. So there's another kind of standard problem of Fiat-Shamir, and I'll just have a few more overheads, so I won't go into this. So what you have to know is if you look at, let's say, an equation of the form x squared equals a mod n, and n is a product of two primes, if the quadratic equation has any solution, it has four solutions, which is quite different than a finite field where a quadratic only has two solutions. And so the idea here is that I would like to be able to, I'm A, I would like to prove to you that I know what the square root of a published V equals F squared mod N is. N is public. And I want to be able to convince you that I know what the square root of V is without divulging what the square root of V is. And so I choose a random R and I send you R squared. R is going to be a blinding thing. Now, this next step I don't really want to get into, but B chooses either 0 or 1 and sends it back to A, and then based on what B sent, A is going to send Y equals R S to the E. So let me just deal with the case where E is equal to 1, the interesting case. E equal to 0 means that only random stuff got transmitted and no information about S really got transmitted. The reason for the E is so A can't cheat in an obvious way. So at that, when B receives RS, he does not know S and he does not know R. He knows RS, but he can't deduce anything about S from RS because R was just a random integer chosen. And but he can square Y and verify that it's equal to X, what he received in the first round, times V, which is published. And so if he keeps repeating this often enough, he has to conclude that in fact A does know what the square root of V, namely S, is. I won't go into that. It's interesting. Something a little more interesting is coin flipping by telephone, which I think is of interest. Namely, we would like to each flip a coin over the telephone, and of course the problems are obvious. I know for a fact you're a very unreliable person and you're likely to cheat. So if I say heads and you win when you have the same, you're going to say heads. And but in fact you can actually do this. So we both decide on an integer n, but only Alice knows the factorization. So Alice chooses the primes p and q, multiplies them together to give n, and broadcasts n. Now Bob has to assume that she's not cheating, and in fact n is a product of two primes. So Bob chooses an x randomly, and computes x squared. Now, it turns out if you know the factorization of n, it's a trivial exercise to find the square roots of n. You can find the square roots mod p and the square roots mod q and combine them with the Chinese remainder theorem and get the square roots mod n. So Alice, because she knows the factorization, can easily find the four square roots, plus or minus a, plus or minus b. She chooses one of them at random. Let's say b, and sends it back. And then Bob checks to see whether actually plus or minus. If B, the one that Alice sent, the root that Alice sent back is either plus or minus X, then Alice wins. If it was not plus or minus X, you see, Bob knows two of the square roots, plus or minus X, because he chose X at random. If you give him the second root, he can actually factor in himself now. He has four roots, and it turns out from knowing four roots, you can actually factor n. So if b equals plus or minus x, Alice wins. If not, Bob produces p and q, sends them to Alice, and she has to admit that in that case, Bob wins. So here's a protocol. You have to admit that it solves the problem at hand. So, one thing... working with my students. Well, there are some other cryptographic primitives that are extremely clever. It's extremely clever work, some of this stuff. Oblivious transfer is whereby you send two messages to a receiver. The receiver can actually only decrypt one, but you have no idea at the transmitter which one he can decrypt. So you're kind of sending information, but you're not sure what he received, he or she received. Secret sharing is a nice protocol. Adi Shamir in Israel has all of these nice ideas, these nice papers. They're all extremely simple and extremely clever. He's one of these people who seems to have a killer instinct to the right problems. And his secret sharing protocol, so the idea of a secret sharing is that we each have little pieces of information that were distributed by some central authority, and if T or more of us get together, we can actually reconstruct the secret. If fewer than T people get together, you have no idea what the secret is. So that's the idea of secret sharing. Now, the great event or millionaire problem that I started out with, the solution, the original solution was completely impractical due to Yao. There was a paper last year by Fishlin in the RSA conference in the cryptography track, and it was kind of ugly. So Vlad has a much better and a much more elegant solution, in my opinion, to this problem. So I was extremely pleased with that. And we have this set intersection and Hamming distance protocol as well. Just about finished. So just to give you an idea of the kind of things that are going on, the crypto community has several quite distinct sub-communities, and there's a protocol community, I think. And so auctions are interesting. There's actually an auction paper recently based on the algorithm of Yao. I'm sorry, auctions, I'm not talking about voting. The auctions, I mean, if you have a greater than protocol where you and I can decide, you think of a number X, I think of a number Y, and we have a protocol decide whether X is greater than Y, well, this is natural for bidding. I mean, N of us now get together, there's a log-in protocol, you implement the greater than protocol on the order of log-in times. So it's not at all surprising that the greater than problem is kind of a cornerstone of an auction. Electronic cash, there's a fellow called David Chaum who was in Holland for many years, but he returned to Palo Alto. And he formed a company called DigiCash. And electronic cash has never gone anywhere for some reason. I'm not exactly sure why. Certified mail, contract signing. How do we sign a contract when we're separated by a large distance? How do you sign a contract electronically so both parties have no chance of being cheated? Voting is an interesting application. There are all sorts of committees in the U.S., federal and state. The California state has a huge committee, and Ron Rivest is active on many of these. He's an excellent cryptographer at MIT. One of the interesting features is the receipt freeness, that you must come up with a system where you may not get a receipt. If you can get a receipt, then you have the ability to sell your vote. That is, if you have a receipt explaining how you voted, that's a receipt. This guy, David Chaum, the same electronic person, has a what he calls kind of a visual cryptography approach to voting, which he is trying to trying to sell to various companies. He's given all sorts of presentations on it, and it's a very interesting system. I don't believe it will go very far, but it's a very interesting idea. A distributed RSA is an interesting one. I don't think it's very practical yet, but the idea here is that we have N people in the room, and we want to come up with a system, the following system. We want to construct an RSA modulus, which is the product of two primes, a public encryption exponent E, and the we each get a share of a private decryption exponent D, so that if enough of us get together, we can decrypt messages. The interesting thing is that you can actually construct an RSA modulus, the product of two primes, without anybody in the room knowing what the two primes are. And these are the kind of ideas that intrigue me. I don't know. You will have noticed that all of the protocols only require very simple mathematics. There's nothing very significant in the protocol mathematics here. So there's just a few problems that get applied. And so all I've really done is given you a brief introduction to some of the computational number theory. It's the application of mathematical notions to derive this information transfer protocols without leakage to achieve some kind of a given purpose. And the real challenge that I'm interested in is how to take these ideas further, how to make these protocols simpler and more elegant using presumably different mathematical techniques than we're currently using. So I'll stop there. Thank you.